On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other fine publications. Our guest today is Lloyd Yavener, the president and COO of Sutton National Group. Welcome, Lloyd.
Great to be here, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah, I was trying to remember how long we've known each other. It's been a while, maybe 20 plus years. Would that be about right? 25, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, probably about 22, 23 years.
Yeah. Okay. We can get into that in a bit. But where are you from originally? I never really asked you that.
Originally, I was born in Washington, D.C., one of the rare natives of that town. As you know, so many of the people live in Washington, come in with administrations and never leave. Born in the city and then grew up in the suburbs before moving to a farm about an hour west of Washington, D.C.
And you still got the farm, right?
We moved back there recently, yeah. We love the life out there, love the people out there. It's close enough where I can get to airports and all the cultural and other values that you can find in a city, but have a nice pastoral, beautiful life in the country.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's been a long journey for you in the insurance industry, going back to 88, I think, and various different industry segments, specialty lines, surplus lines. And then you've done a lot of the plumbing work, as it were, for insurance, the stuff that people don't really realize how important it is and how time consuming it can be. And that's sort of the legal and the regulatory piece. And you're a lawyer, so all that kind of tracks. But how did you get involved in this this field, and why do you stay?
That's a great question. I did practice law for about 2 years before going into the insurance business full time, and I just, my nature is to get along with people and have sort of win-win type relationships. And of course, in law, there's very often a winner and a loser in a case or whatever the conflict was. So I'd done that for about 2 years and had the opportunity to work for a small insurance company, starting in their claims department, doing legal work and subrogation, and immediately realized that insurance process can be a win-win, right? A carrier can hopefully make a profit writing insurance. A customer can get their needs satisfied when they have a loss. And so it appealed to me from that perspective, that the transaction of insurance didn't have to be a win-lose. And so when I got into the business, I was in the claims department originally, and then started working on the policy side and distribution and legal and regulatory. And it fascinated me because the insurance industry sees the entire world, the entire economy, through the lens of risk. And so, when you look at the news today, the news cycle's 24/7 with cable, but people are fascinated by what's happening around the world. Very often it's a disaster, not always bad stuff, but certainly that everybody's interested in what's happening. And the insurance industry is behind everything. And my young children at the time asked me a similar question: why are you so excited about insurance? Well, you see everything through the lens of insurance. In every building, in every car, and every concert you go to, there's insurance behind everything. So that's really the driving force that got me into the industry, and that's keeping me in the industry, because the world of risk changes as the economies change, and more of a global approach to the economic interests of all the countries, and insurance is behind all of it. That's really what got me interested, and why I'm still so engaged and so interested in what we do.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Sutton National, for those who don't know, what your mission is, the customers, the business partners you work with, and how you're trying to forge maybe a different path than your competitors.
Yeah, well, as you know, we're a program writer, Peter, and we write exclusively through program administrators, or MGAs, that they'll be called under certain circumstances. And this delegation of authority is really what we do. So we operate through best-in-class program administrators to whom we delegate authority to accept or reject risk on our behalf. And the approach that we've taken, the first real sort of fronting company of any significance with State National, and of course still a big presence in the industry, but a relatively passive model, and where they the risk is passed through them to reinsurers, and that's their model, is to access capacity through their paper, acting as a program writer. And we took a different view, and we're referred to traditionally as a hybrid front-end company. But if you look at the spectrum of companies who are underwriting program business, if State National is on one side with a relatively clear pass-through model, we like to think that we add a lot more value. So we viewed the industry as needing more of that. And so we have built a platform that in many respects resembles a more traditional carrier, but we are operating in a delegated authority environment. So that our mission really is to provide great capacity to the market by adding meaningful value through the unparalleled expertise that we bring, effective collaboration both internally on our team and with our counterparties, and most critically, the alignment of interests. So we can take a pretty significant percentage of the underlying risk and have less reliance on reinsurance, so that everyone's interests are aligned. So, you know, our program administrators will typically have a commission structure that rises and falls with the loss experience. So we're aligned with them. We take a meaningful amount of risk. We're aligned. And of course, the reinsurers who are taking the bulk of the risk, we're all aligned. And we think that's critical in the industry, is have that alignment and high level of collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of stuff are you writing at Sutton National?
Yeah, the continuum of commodity versus specialty, we consider ourselves more on the specialty side. So if you can go find that insurance at the corner insurance store or online simply through an application, it's probably not what we're going to do. So we view how we approach the industry as being more towards specialized risk, where there's a higher pace of change. So we are writing homeowners in states like California, Texas, and Florida, up and down the Eastern Seaboard and Gulf Coast, where it's much tougher to get those policies placed and those risks covered. But we, beyond homeowners, we're doing certain types of trucking business. We're doing general contractors. We're doing ocean marine, inland marine, personal yachts. So again, where it's more difficult for people to find the coverage, particularly in more cat-prone areas. And we also do some lines of business which are rather unique. We're playing a lot now in the entertainment space, so event cancellation, and where we're taking smaller bets on a lot of these different events. And so branching out there, we do everything, some of the more traditional specialty lines, but where there's more risk involved and more volatility. And we have one program where we insure the increasingly complex compensation structures for NCAA coaches. And, you know, for the schools to attract good coaches, they've got to give them incentives, and those incentive packages sometimes are very complex. And we have a product in the marketplace that helps the school smooth their results by insuring that risk. So if they go all the way, that large incentive comp might be covered.
That's really interesting. God, I love that side of the business. The specialty side is so cool. But how has it evolved over the time you spent in the specialty lines? You mentioned alignment. I think that's certainly noteworthy. And, you know, you would like to think that your competitors are striving for some kind of alignment there. But how has it evolved, and how are you guys staying ahead of that evolution?
Yeah, that's a great question. As you look at the insurance industry, it was very static for a long period of time. It was a paper business, and I've noted in several places where I worked where they'll say, "Well, hey, that's the way we've always done it," and that's a characteristic of our industry for quite some time. With the advent of technology, the pace of change started to occur much more rapidly, and the traditional insurance carrier model was a little bit slower in adapting to change. And other financial services, from banking and the mortgage business and investment securities, they adopted technology a lot quicker than insurance companies did. And so as we look at the nature of risk changing and the nature of technology changing, we have seen the delegated authority model growing as a percentage of the marketplace because their ability to adapt quickly to change, deploy technology quicker, whereas the traditional legacy systems of the larger carriers, you know, they were a little bit slower to adapt to change. You know, they were built for that sort of, hey, this is the way we've always done it. And it still works in some lines of insurance that are highly commoditized, and they can still play in that space. But the two main drivers were technology. Sort of the first big change that I've seen in my career was the adoption of online quoting and binding and policy servicing in the 1990s. And everybody was, our industry was sort of caught flat-footed in how quick that pace of change started to happen. So we saw, as the industry started to adopt technology, that enabled the industry to respond better to the faster pace of change of underlying risk. There was no such thing as cyber insurance, you know, 40 years ago. And when you think about what technology has done and the risks that have happened because of that, and the changing nature of underlying risk, as all the components of the economy are now adopting technology, those risks are changing, and your ability to manage that risk. And, you know, I would have never thought that you'd have drones looking at construction sites and, you know, videoing what's there and assessing what the risk looks like. So sort of real-time loss control that we never dreamed of when we first got in the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting. All these newer lines, employment practices liability was one. All the pollution stuff. It's so interesting how the cannabis field is ginormous and still growing, and everywhere you look, there's a need for coverage. You know, it's pretty cool.
Yep, for sure. And as we've seen those changes occur, the ability to react quickly to emerging risk and the needs for insurance to cover that risk, the MGA model, the delegated authority model, has a greater ability to adapt and address those needs. And the surplus lines market is growing more rapidly than the admitted segment of the market. And that enables, And the regulatory schemes are designed to enable that. And the states have been very aware that, hey, if somebody can't buy this insurance in the admitted market, they need to get that coverage so they can do their business. So that's what the surplus lines market has always been about. But with the faster pace of change of the underlying economy, of technology, and the way we live and work, the surplus lines segment of the market is growing more rapidly to enable a faster pace of response to the needs in the marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty, pretty interesting how it has grown so much. It once was maybe 5 or 10% of the market. What is it? It's gotta be 20 now. In coastal areas, it might even be higher. I know here in Florida, without surplus lines, it would only be like a state solution for homeowners at least. So, yeah, incredibly important that, and of course it takes some explanation, if retail agents are involved, you know, explaining to customers who these brands are, who these companies are. And, it's a little bit of the Wild West, I think, which is the other side, I guess, of regulation, because without, regulatory oversight, I think there would have been faster change in the insurance industry, and perhaps a lot of it not so good. There would have been people coming in without going through all the hoops that I know you've gone through your whole career with making sure things are buttoned down with the regulators on the state level, right?
Yeah, that's true. And hey, we respect and appreciate the role of regulators, right? They're there to help us and help the consumer. And so we view their role as critical. All of the states have a surplus lines, the ability for companies to write on a surplus lines basis, and that's critical. And they recognize that. The the laws that apply to claims administration and cancellation and non-renewal, they all still apply to the surplus law inside. It's really just the rate and form flexibility that enables the surplus lines writers to react quickly to changing profile of risk and the needs of the consumer. The delegated authority model has changed a lot in my career. The MGA was a four-letter word when I first got in the business. It was considered a very challenging space to be in. And that has fundamentally changed over the course of my career, Peter. And what was once a more broker-driven model, and nothing against brokers, but their goal was to write insurance, and that's their model, is to write insurance and write more insurance. And of course, an underwriter's goal is to write business profitably. So what we've seen as that segment of the market has grown more rapidly than the traditional market because of the needs of the consumer and their needs that are evolving, that MGA program administration model, delegated authority model, is responding to those needs better and quicker. And what's happened is there's been a lot more opportunity for existing businesses in the delegated authority environment and new ones to get in. So there's been a lot of talent that's come out of the traditional insurance market, particularly underwriting talent, product talent, compliance talent, that's moving into the delegated authority space, program administration space, because it's growing, the needs are growing, and so there's more opportunity there. So we've seen the role of the MGA shift from being sort of a broker who was producing business with varying degrees of underwriting expertise being deployed, now to the program administrators, MGAs in the market, are highly sophisticated underwriting shops with a lot of talent, and they look just like an insurance company without the balance sheet. So that's been a fundamental shift in my career. It's been a great shift. It's been great to watch it. I think it's brilliant how technology has changed so quickly over the last three decades, and our industry has been able to adapt to that change through this delegated authority model by having really smart underwriting talent move into that space, develop MGAs to respond to those risks. And you mentioned cannabis, but it goes so much beyond that into how technology works. And when you look at our ability to parse DNA and get deep into science, those insurance needs have to follow all of that, life sciences. Mm-hmm. And so the complexity is staggering. And our industry's ability to react to those changes and provide products has really been impressive, but it's accelerating.
Yeah. Let me go a little, maybe we can go a little bit deeper on that point about the traditional carrier. I guess this goes way back, maybe to the 80s, early 90s. I was doing a lot of freelance writing on insurance topics, and there was this new thing called captive insurance, people standing up captives. And the idea was that you go straight to basically, and self-insured model. It could be spread across many like-minded business owners in a particular business, say like trucking or something. And there are all kinds of captives, obviously, you know what I'm talking about. But yep. The point is, I always thought then, well, what happens to traditional insurance companies that when they first started, and still many today, they got to be good at a lot of things, but are they? Can they be good at a lot of things? Can they be good at all kinds of commercial and personal lines, right? I mean, and you see with this idea that niches are riches, which somebody said to me once at a Target Markets conference, you see specialty, you see independent agents who specialize, brokers, obviously the MGAs do it, the PAs do it. You're doing it. The specialization where you become good at a particular thing. You're the people who are underwriting it know what to look for. They know what questions to ask. They have the relationships. They can book the business. They can watch it, and it's a comfort zone as opposed to the one-off thing that they're trying to write through a standard lines company. This is a kind of a long way of asking you. Like, I don't know how much longer traditional carriers can hang around in what they've been doing. And I know they're getting better, many of them, with technology, of course. But it's almost like they're destined to become specialist as well, because I think it's better for the consumer. It's better profitability if you know what you're doing in these niches. But it's also better for the consumer if you have someone who kind of understands the world you're dealing with and is that relief valve if it's a troubled area like the cap-prone areas. So anyway, do you agree with any of that, Lloyd?
Well, it's interesting. We all of us tend to think in absolutes. And there was an article in Best Week in the early 90s about online quoting and binding. And the article was titled, it might even be in a headline, "The Death of the Agent." And the premise of the article was, hey, if you can buy insurance online direct, what do we need agents for? And of course, that it hasn't played out. And so there are no absolutes. And I think a lot of what we're writing today as specialized lines of business, like cyber insurance, that's going to be a commodity one day. Once people get their arms around it, it becomes a mature industry. And I think more traditional traditional carriers are well-suited for commodity business. So I think there'll always be a role for them. But when it comes to emerging risk, and you mentioned the captive, you know, the captive is sort of an arm-in-arm component of an emerging risk. A program administrator who recognizes that needs and forms an MGA to address those emerging risks and needs. The captive is very often a component of that because the traditional reinsurance structures may not be ready to provide capacity for that emerging risk. So they tend to go hand in hand. But I see the pace of change in our economy continues, there will be an ever-growing segment of the marketplace that is in this sort of delegated authority model where smart people who can underwrite and apply capacity to risk will continue to do that and utilize alternative risk, whether it's captive or cat bonds and, you know, the various alternative risk strategies. So that will be there. But I think at some point it's likely that the treatment of cannabis at the federal level will change. And when that changes, all of the traditional carriers who now are kind of worried about covering something that's illegal at the federal level, that may become more of a commodity in time. So I see it as an ongoing cycle. Emerging risk comes up. The specialty market finds a way to satisfy the needs of the marketplace. And then if it matures into a more traditional risk, then it gets back into the traditional carrier space. So I see it as a very amorphous and evolving dynamic.
Yeah, it's that's a great way to describe it. I just don't know if a coastal property, you think it'll ever get back to the standard commodity carriers? They just can't make it work financially, it seems, in states like Florida.
It's a challenge. There's a lot of dynamics happening there. You know, one is, if you go back 100 years, there weren't that many houses right along the coast. It wasn't densely populated. And then if you start down south and go from Miami to Fort Lauderdale and Jacksonville, go up the coast, and all there's very large population centers along the water. And if you look at a probable maximum loss of any event, and the models today can take any historic storm and say, hey, what's this going to cause in terms of damage? There's just a lot more risk in those coastal environments. Mm-hmm. And similarly in California, you look at the wildfire risk and earthquake risk, there's just a lot more insured value. So the industry has to be mindful of that there needs to be a lot more capacity to cover that risk. Mm-hmm. And when a company's bucket is full in all these different geographies, you know, they have to limit the amount that they could write there. So the surplus lines market, the specialty market, and the MGA market are ideally suited to bring in additional capacity. And we saw it after 2005, the year of Katrina, a lot of alternative capacity came into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, the first big wave in my career of alternative capacity coming in and say, hey, folks just can't get their houses covered. So, okay, it's going to be surplus lines, probably going to be a delegated authority model, and it's going to be alternative risk out of Bermuda that's going to come in and provide the capacity. So that was the first sort of an event that everybody watched and saw what happened, and the market reacted to it. And most people got their insurance And to this day, that dynamic still exists where when the traditional markets can only write so much in their model, that alternative capacity, specialty lines writers, surplus lines writers come in and cover those gaps.
Yeah. Lloyd, let's switch gears a little bit. I wanted to ask you about leadership. I mean, you've had a career in which you've overseen a lot of people. When I first met you, it was the marketing team at Clements International up in D.C. But you've gone on to other roles too, you know, product, legal, et cetera. What is your core leadership philosophy?
Yeah, I've done a lot of leadership training in the past. And you know, leadership, if you take two people in our industry or in industry, if you look at, you know, Warren Buffett has his own leadership style. And then you look around at different people in our industry, they're very different in how they approach that. So I don't think there's any one approach to leadership. It's about people. And Richard Branson, for example, is a very different person, an amazing leader, built amazing businesses and been great for the economy and the world in general, but so different than Warren Buffett. So when you think about leadership, there's only one thing that all great leaders have in common, and that's followers. And so how do you make that happen? And it's really on a person-to-person basis. So it you can't do it by memo, and you can't put a poster up in the break room. It really comes down to, you know, sort of character, integrity, openness, honesty, and trust, and devoting the time to people. And I don't think there's any other way to do it, is to take it person by person, group by group, build that level of trust. So you have, if you're honoring commitments and doing the right thing and expressing appreciation and speaking respectfully to people and listening thoughtfully, you know, the best leaders, and I put myself not necessarily in the group of best leaders, but I've made a career of hiring people who are smarter at what they do than I am and better at what they do than I am, and putting them in positions to succeed. That builds a sense of fulfillment, builds a sense of pride in the company and what you're doing. And I don't think there's any other way to lead people effectively than to put them in that position to succeed so that they're getting everything they want out of their careers and they feel fulfilled. And I think that's critical. And one of the key parts of my job as a leader at Sutton National is to make everybody proud of being a part of Sutton. And if somebody is proud of their business and proud of what they do, all the other behavioral aspects of being a good person and being a good worker and being a good professional will follow.
Yeah. Well, that's good stuff. I've always wondered why, if there was one thing I could point to, this is not Lloyd talking, this is me talking, on why insurance has been slower to evolve than, you mentioned, financial services, for example. This is me, okay? I don't want to put words in your mouth, pal, but I think it's just that the folks running companies, CEO, you know, maybe in charge of a business line, they kind of grew up from the field of underwriting, actuary. Maybe they came out of the field, you know, running the field operations or something. And I think there's a lot of things that can go wrong in the insurance industry if you do it wrong with the math side of it, you know, making sure that you actually make a profit. But I wonder if that's kind of heavy on the left side, rational thinkers, and less on the emotional side, where you need to have a little bit of a blend and see the people side that you describe. So I wonder if that's part of it, because I think if you could give some advice to someone who's stepping into leadership role in a very difficult business, there's nothing really easy about this. You can lose money really fast. You can lose your rating fast. You can go out of business really fast. Takes longer to get the profits going, right? So what would you say? Like, what you mentioned some things, but is it different in insurance? Is there additional complexity when it comes to leadership and insurance today?
Well, those are great questions. I'm going to break it up into two questions. The first is, why was our industry slow to adopt change? And what I think the consumer doesn't understand how complex it is, from an operational perspective, from a regulatory oversight perspective, capturing data, managing data, you are taking a lot of risks. And when you think of what it takes to run a traditional insurance company, from distribution and agents, and you can't just hang up a sign and suddenly the agents are producing, it's hard to break into the industries with a lot of old mutuals with, you know, their distribution that have been around for generations. And then it comes into policy issuance and the compliance requirements to issue a policy and the state regs on what you can and can't do, and the actuarial requirements to support your rates, and then the claims administration, and then the reporting, the statistical reporting, the financial reporting. They're incredibly complex processes and procedures that have to be highly orchestrated. So before technology was really utilized heavy by our industry, it took a long time to stand up a new line of insurance at a traditional company. All of those mechanisms across the spectrum had to change and be coordinated and have that level of collaboration. So I think there was a natural delay in terms of the adoption of technology. So that's why I think we've always been behind the curve. We're seeing that accelerate now.
Okay.
But as I look toward new leaders in the industry, you know, how can you be successful? How can you get a business going or help grow your business? I really think it comes back to people and how you're engaging people, bringing them in specific roles. I think the average person today has a different view of what a job means than my dad, who fought in World War II and was, you know, pretty traditional guy and grateful to have come home alive from Europe. And, you know, his needs were more basic, I think, than people today and what they're looking for. Just a natural evolution of the human being and the deployment of technology, where TV commercials when I was young were 30-second spots with one person talking and not much movement. Now a TV commercial, you know, it might be 2 seconds for each image, and that this rapid fire of information that's coming at us. So I think from my perspective, it's still a people business. Mm-hmm. Other than the folks who are going online and can buy something at a portal, buy their insurance online, if there's any more complexity to the risk, certainly on the commercial side, or even homeowners that might have multiple homes and boats and different aspects of their, maybe they have a rental property, it's a VRBO, and, you know, suddenly you just can't go online and buy that insurance. And well, guess what? You're going to pick up the phone and speak to somebody. And then as you get up in the food chain of risk, we are a highly people-centric business. Look, we have capital. Our capital is the same as every other insurance company. We have laptops and systems that capture data. They're all the same. And what really differentiates us is the people who work for our company. And to a person, we have been able to inspire and motivate a team of people and to make them engaged in the mission, make them a part of the mission. And very quickly after we started Sutton National, they became the engine of the company. And we've put them in the position to make decisions, to help guide the direction of the company. So what we started with some core philosophies about alignment, collaboration, and culture, it's our team now driving the change and bringing it. So our industry is full of people who are making it happen. And certainly AI, we can talk about that, but, you know, AI is coming into our marketplace like it is at breakneck speed, but it's still a people business. And and then I would have to put in a plug for our industry to anybody who doesn't know about it. It's a really cool business.
Yeah.
So if you like racing cars, guess what? There's a lot of insurance for racing cars and the J-Series yacht races and insurance behind that. And oil tankers and whatever you're interested in, the event cancellation we do and understanding what it takes to put on a really big festival and the amount of risk that's involved there. And if that event gets canceled, just how much of a claim that might be for everything from porta potties to vendors to logistics. And so it's a fascinating business. Anything that you think is super cool in the world today, there's probably insurance behind it. So it's been difficult to get, you know, younger people in a world we live in where they They've got TikTok and they can see some really cool stuff. But behind that is generally there's some level of risk assumption happening.
Yeah, which is why people, when they discover insurance as an employment brand, as a place to work, they're like, oh, this is different. This is not what I thought. It's actually really cool. And I love the people. I love the work. There's so many different careers you can pursue in the insurance industry. And I think that if we could solve that, if we could get Gen Z, which is the professionals, emerging professionals in their 20s, you know, looking at the industry in a different way, you know, they might see the product itself in a different way as well, which would be really cool. Maybe I'm asking for too much, but it is a cool industry. And I think that's one of the biggest myths about our industry, that it's, you know, not old guys in bad suits selling life insurance, you know. There's a lot more to it. But yeah. somehow that picture just keeps getting passed down generation to generation. It's like, oh, I don't want to be a life insurance salesman. No, you don't have to do that part.
Right. I mean, that is the image of, you know, here's a coffee mug and a polo shirt. That's what somebody's doing, selling insurance. The number of people involved in our industry is way beyond the distribution arm of our business. And you mentioned actuaries and underwriters and the modelers and product people. There's some interesting, really interesting elements of our business. I think we can sell it best by discussing the underlying risk.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you like motorsports. Would you insure, right? Well, I think they call them run what you brung, where you show up to the racetrack on the weekend and you race the car and you drove there. And hey, that's a pretty interesting risk.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, my father-in-law was a life and health insurance sales guy. He was one of the good guys, you know, one of the ones who, it is an incredibly important product to have good advice around life insurance, no doubt about it. But it's the image of the guy who walks up to you at a cocktail party and just starts trying to sell you stuff. People cringe. And I just don't get why that's this image of the entire insurance industry. But anyway, that if that's something we could fix in my career, I'd be a happy camper, because I've been doing this for decades like you.
Well, the American Marketing Association, with the advent of technology, the four P's of marketing changed. And it before technology, the four P's were product, price, placement, and promotion. And when you think about it, that is the perspective of the company selling something. And when you think of the image of an insurance salesman pushing something on a consumer, the world doesn't work that way anymore. And the AMA flipped it completely, 180 degrees, and said, well, no, that's the perspective of somebody selling something, and hot dogs and balloons and come here to buy a car. And consumers don't want that anymore. And so the AMA went to product and price became solution and value, and placement and promotion became access to information. And those are the four elements of marketing today. Because when you think about it, if you need something, and we're all in this position all the time, hey, we need something for the bathroom, or we need something for the yard, the first thing you do is go online, and it's access to information. And suddenly you've got a whole array of different options there for you. And then you're looking for a valuable solution, and whatever that value curve is, right? Red Roof is the lower left end of the value curve, and a Ritz-Carlton is in the upper. And so you've got that value curve that you can, from which you can choose. And I think that consumer's view has changed so much, and the insurance industry needs to change the way it markets its products. But I think it has. I think the MGA model has changed that considerably, where it really is focusing on delivering valuable solutions and providing people access to information through typically the wholesale insurance community. And so those people are saying, wow, I've got this emerging risk, and I just was told from my insurance agent that this is not coverage. How do I find that? And hey, like never before, people can go out and their agent may call a wholesaler who's like, hey, I know somebody who does that. And suddenly you're connected to a niche specialty writer that might be a part of the Sutton world. And they're like, yeah, hey, we do this. This is something that we do. And it's that I think the AMA recognized it a long time ago, and consumers think differently about what they need. And I think our industry can continue to get better by providing valuable solutions and providing people access to information for the risks they might have.
Yeah. All right, Lloyd, let me ask you a few questions about you, just kind of a rapid fire round, if you're up for that. If you, as you look back on your career, is there anything you're particularly proud of and maybe a decision you might want to revisit if you were able to?
Well, and I'll start with the decision that I'd like to revisit. And that was in the 1990s, and it was a pricing decision. And our producers were telling us, this was non-standard auto in the mid-Atlantic, and they're like, you guys don't allow for a lapse in coverage, because typically if there's a lapse in coverage, it signifies a consumer who might not be as attuned to risk as you might. And we said, and they're like, hey, we can write a lot of business if you open your guidelines up. And we opened them up. I think it was for an 8% surcharge. And after the statistics came in, it needed to be an 18 or 20% surcharge. So for anyone who might be listening who remembers that time in my career, we made an error there. And our business is very sensitive to risk. And that was a really valuable lesson for me to learn. And when I say value, it was valuable. It was very costly. So the lesson I learned from that is that you think very carefully about the assumption of risk, utilize professionals who really know it, and do your research before you just open up something. And, you know, we've certainly seen it without naming names in some of the insurtechs who have like, hey, we can get a ton of business in the door through this online platform, and everybody needs this type of insurance, and the risk come pouring in, and it takes them a long time, some of them to turn the corner into profitability. So it's an age-old lesson, and it's one that I learned, thankfully, pretty early in my career. So that's probably the biggest.
And which one were you proud of?
The most proud of is more of a series.
Yeah.
And for me, it was the migration away from a traditional carrier.
Yeah.
Which I didn't find as inspiring and motivating, and moving into specialty insurance. Mm. And so I evolved. I was always doing program business. My company early in my career supported Clements Worldwide, that provided insurance for U.S. expats living and working abroad, and particularly the U.S. State Department people living abroad, and providing first party coverage for their household effects and vehicles they took over. And so I've always done specialty and program business, but it was in a traditional carrier model. And I'd done that for quite some time. And I'm most proud of it would have been 2017, joining my partner then and my partner now, Shane Haverstick, in getting into the pure hybrid front model and doing it very thoughtfully and saying, okay, we want to be different. We want to add value. And I had gone to the American Marketing Association meetings and learned about this access to information and valuable solution, and said, hey, what people really need are specialty products that can be delivered to the market quickly, and they need alignment of interest, because again, the MGA's world is not looked at favorably back in the day. And so that was my most, I'm most proud of having made that leap in my career to doing startup hybrid fronting companies and providing what we do to the marketplace.
So if you weren't in insurance, what would you be doing, Lloyd? I have a hunch, but you go ahead and tell the listeners.
Well, it's currently my backup plan, and that's playing music. I've been a musician my whole career. I love music and art. I do a lot of art and a lot of music on the side, and I would be playing music full time if I weren't in the insurance business. And I've learned a lot from playing music that's been really helpful to me in my professional career. Because if you get together with some folks and you start a band, it's not like a company. There's no employee handbook. There's no regulations. There's nothing. It's just some people getting together. Yeah. So it's building a team, having alignment of interests, empowering people, finding out what is important to everybody, and making sure the direction of the band fits for everybody, so that it's a sort of collective view. So I've learned a lot about people and how to inspire and motivate people and listen to people, and so that you get a great outcome. And music's taught me a lot in terms of how you orchestrate, make things happen, play a show, make people happy. And there's no handbook on how to do that.
That's pretty cool. What instruments, what do you like to play, or what are you good at?
I'm primarily a drummer and a singer. I do play guitar and sing as well, but you know, the folks who I play with would say, no, you're a drummer. I've always been fascinated by rhythm. There's some great articles about rhythm, and you know, they'll play music and they'll see primates kind of moving with the music.
Yeah.
And it's part of our hypothalamus, our old brain, and so just part of who I am.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, the bass and the percussion are like kind of run the show, don't they?
I have to say, as cool as insurance is, playing music and being able to do that throughout my life has been just a little bit cooler.
So if you could give your younger self some advice, what path would you go? I mean, you got two now, so it's not like either or, but would it have been professional musician where you get paid, or would you just stuck in insurance or got into insurance?
It would be easy to say that I would have loved being a musician, but when I look at life, I'm all about balance. And so I like to have that balance in life. So the professional career has been stimulating academically, and I live by the rule of the four A's or the five A's. So I want to do something every day that's academic, something that's athletic, something that's artistic, something that's amorous, showing people the love, and something that's altruistic, doing things for other people. So the insurance industry has enabled me to do that and to help people build careers. There is a level of art in our business. There's certainly an academic component to it. The athletic bit, that's pretty much outside of the insurance space. And then there's the amorous part, to really show the love to people who you work with in your business or counterparties. And so there's been a lot of parallels in my life between what I do professionally and what I do on the side for fun.
Yeah. There's two more quick ones, Lloyd. Do you have a mentor that you could point to that made a difference in your life and your career path?
Yeah, there's been a number of people who have taught me so much. It's a very difficult. There was one time when we had some real challenges. Our company had been acquired by American Livestock and Insurance Company, and it was about the time that we were hitting some real challenges from Progressive and other really big companies who frankly did a better job pricing that we did. And a competitor came into our market and offered commissions that were considerably higher than us. And our agents were like, hey, we're going to have to switch our business. And at the time, I spoke to Duncan Alexander, who was the CEO and owner of American Livestock. And his words to me at that time, he said, Lloyd, there's times when you get bit by a snake and you're sitting on the side of the river, and you have to realize that thrashing around is going to be the worst thing for you, and you just have to sit calmly so that venom doesn't go through you faster and figure out what's the best course of action. And that was the best advice and guidance I've ever gotten in my career from Duncan. I'll never forget him for that. And it really taught me that, hey, in the face of challenge, it's the time to be very calm about it. And, you know, if you hit a bad situation, I like my partner Shane so much because his voice goes down an octave when something big is happening. And instead of reacting and flailing around, we like to think of ourselves as being really cerebral and say, okay, what are the possible outcomes? We should take our time, be very measured about how we react. And that Duncan Alexander gave me the best advice of my career, amongst a lot of good advice that I got.
Yeah, that's great. And do you have any goals still on your radar? This is the last question for you, Lloyd. Anything you'd like to accomplish in your professional or personal life?
Well, I am grateful to say that in both aspects of my life, I feel great about the people who have shared my life with me and what we do together. And it's always a collective approach. you know, professionally, I would like to carry on this mission and enable all the people in Sutton National who are, have effectively taken over every aspect of our business to see it through, to see all of them realize all of their goals in their careers.
That's awesome. Okay, my friend. Well, I really appreciate your time today, and let's keep in touch.
Sounds great. Always a pleasure, Peter.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.